Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something that can help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance. And here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers, we reflect, we prepare, we think deeply about the challenging issues of our time, and we work through this philosophy in a way that's more possible here when we're not rushing to work or to get the kids to school, when we have the time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with our journals, and to prepare for what the future will bring. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year. So you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic podcast. As you know, I recently had one of my heroes, Robert Greene, on the show. We talked about the pandemic quarantine. We talked about a live time, dead time. You know, we talked about political sensitivities, how one learns to tamp down their triggers, the things that they disagree with, the things that make them angry, as Robert talks about in his book, The Laws of Human Nature. And then we also talked about sort of what great leadership in times of crisis looks like. Well, I wanted to also share another interview that I did with Robert, this one in the fall of 2018. Robert Greene was putting out The Laws of Human Nature and suddenly, as I've talked about on this podcast before, suddenly had a stroke and it looked like the whole launch was thrown into doubt and he wasn't going to be able to do any media appearances. He wasn't going to be able to travel. It was really touch and go for a long time. And I actually thought they should pause the whole thing. I was much too worried about his health to think that any book launch was worth it, as amazing as the book was. I thought we should just wait until the spring. But anyways, they ended up proceeding. And so what Robert asked me to do was come out to Los Angeles to interview him on his couch where he didn't have to travel, where he could trust the person interviewing him, where we could just have a conversation about the ideas in the book and put those ideas out in the world. And it was obviously an honor to do it. I agreed in 2 seconds. Any chance I have to have the opportunity to spend time with Robert Greene, who I just love and adore, obviously going to take. So I flew out there and we had this conversation and it was a great one. And it sort of has existed out there in limbo. I put it on my YouTube channel. I put it on Robert's Facebook. But You know, so much time has passed. We've had so many new subscribers. And I do think the ideas in his books are so timeless. So I wanted to run that as today's episode for you. We talk about a bunch of important things in the interview. We talk about Amor Fati. We talk about Memento Mori, obviously Robert's brush with death, which is a sort of a deeply Stoic concept. We talk about the importance of illustrating ideas through stories, which has obviously influenced my writing a great deal. You know, this is just a touching interview. I look back at that time now, and I'm on the one hand so glad that he's come as far as he has. And then it's also incredible for me to be sitting here in 2020 and think about just all the things that have happened in the world since then. I mean, it's incredible. You know, we talk about Amor Fati and Memento Mori in the interview, and who would have thought that, you know, in that intervening period, just the things that would happen. I mean, that we would be dealing with a pandemic that has rippled through the world. And I guess that's really what Stoicism is about, right? It's like when we look back at the past, we have this sense of how naive we were, how much we were taking for granted, how all the things we weren't thinking of. And so revisiting this conversation was a reminder of that for me and something I wanted to share with you. And of course, if you haven't read The Laws of Human Nature, it's an absolute must read. Robert is a master of his craft, certainly the master I believe I am apprenticing under. If you haven't read his other books like The 48 Laws of Power, 33 Strategies of War, one of my favorites, Mastery, you absolutely should. You can follow his email list, which is great, at powerseductionwar.com. On Instagram, he's Robert Greene Official. On Twitter, I believe he's at Robert Greene. I think he's one of the great living nonfiction authors of our time. And again, the theme ultimately of this piece is just how even the great living masters can quite easily become the not living masters. And we should cherish people while we still can. So enjoy this interview. Be safe out there. And we'll be back with another episode for you in just a few days. So I'm here talking to Robert Greene about his new book, The Laws of Human Nature. This book is how many years in the making?
I would say between 5 and 6, but it's probably more like 58 years in the making, you know?
Why did you decide to write this book? So you came off Mastery, which is about how we sort of find our life's task and how we achieve, you know, sort of mastery over it. Why did you decide to go from there to Human Nature?
Well, in Mastery, we have chapter 4 on social intelligence. And one thing was readers really responded to that chapter. They really liked it. But I got the sense that they wanted more. Like, could you expand this? People kept asking me, well, how do you read people by their body language? Things that I kind of opened up in that chapter. So I sensed there was a hunger for this kind of knowledge dealing with social intelligence, but sort of from a different angle. You know how I don't look at things from the usual self-help, positive, Pollyannish angle. I look at it from the dark side.
Right.
That people are actually hiding a lot of inner turmoil and aggressive impulses. And I felt that there was a hunger for more of that kind of knowledge. But also in the 20 years of writing Power and researching it and consulting with many different powerful people, I had this feeling that people are really difficult. It's what I write a lot about. And we spend so much of our time, particularly now in the 21st century, dealing with technology, dealing with our phones, dealing with algorithms. It's like we're immersed in this. But the source of our misery, the source of our pain, the source of why we're so fucking messed up right now is we don't understand people. People can't be reduced to an algorithm. You can't figure them out through your smartphone. And I've dealt with people who are very powerful, who are brilliant in their field, and they come to me with the simplest psychological problem, a political problem. I can't handle this partner. So I had this feeling, you know, when I wrote Mastery, I sensed that we're losing a sense of how to make things. And I really wanted to address that. Well, I also felt in this book, we're losing a sense of psychology, of what makes people tick. And it's causing cascading problems in the world. So I felt an urgency to kind of address something that people don't talk about.
And so mastering this social intelligence, as you call it, why is that something that the average
the average person needs to know. I get why maybe the president needs to master social intelligence, but if I'm a writer or I'm an athlete or I go to a football team, walk me through the case for...
Well, I mean, I've consulted with athletes, very high-level NBA basketball player. He came to me, I won't say his name, because the owner of the team was messing with him. Like, he was obviously wanting to trade him, but publicly he was saying all sorts of... He couldn't figure him out. And it really was hurting him psychologically, and it was affecting his game, and it was messing with his relationship with his wife. So it's ridiculous to think that in some field you're not having to deal with people. If you're a parent, you have to deal with your child, and children are extremely difficult. They're extremely resistant to your will. They don't want to do what you want them to do. Right. How do you deal with that? If you're bad at dealing with people, if you don't understand their psychology, if you push them too much and they resist you, you respond and react and you get kind of defensive and bitter and resentful. And what happens is your mind is consumed 24 hours a day with, damn it, this person didn't answer my email. Damn it, this person didn't do that. It's wearing away at you. It's eating your mental space. You have no mental space for creative endeavors, for actually doing your work. It drains you. It emotionally drains you. You're imbalanced because you're constantly thinking about what people aren't giving you. I want you to reverse that perspective and think of what you're not giving people, other people, so that you can actually begin to change this dynamic and get out of that sense of waiting and passivity.
And when you sit down to research a book like this, walk us through your research methodology, because obviously I was your research assistant, and so I know it, and it changed how I come up with ideas and brainstorm and collect information. But how does that process work for you as you start to hone in on an idea that you're...
By the way, you were the best researcher I've ever had.
Thank you.
I wish I could clone you.
I would like you to let me keep doing it, but you won't.
Oh, you're too powerful. I saw that you were like number 6 on Amazon's business writer list. How can I hire someone like that to do my research? It'd be ridiculous. But anyway, I'll consider that for the next book.
Okay.
But the research process is very laborious, but there's a method behind the madness, which is I try and keep an open mind. Now, I have a bias towards human nature, towards people. My bias is negative. I tend to think people are actually worse than they probably are.
Okay.
As opposed to Steven Pinker, who thinks that people are probably better than they actually are. I admit my bias.
Yeah.
So that helps me. I know that that's there. But I want to combat my bias and open my mind up to all the information. So my process was to start reading books that would kind of open up different vistas on human nature. So a lot on neuroscience, Ramachandran, Antonio Damasio, about how we process information and things about our emotions and how the brain processes emotions. I read a lot of books by psychologists from the classic period, the period when these people aren't very fashionable now, like Carl Jung, like Heinz Kohut, like a man named Ronald Fairbairn, Wilfred Bion. An incredible resource of amazing information about people. Like, for instance, there's a psychologist named Melanie Klein who spent her whole life studying infants and the psychoanalyzing infants. Can you imagine what that's like? Now, if you're looking at from a mastery point of view, a 10,000-hour point of view, she spent 20,000 hours studying infants and their psychology. She understands them on a level that's amazing.
Right.
So these people have an incredible resource, these psychologists. So I went into that. I went into anthropology. My particular bias is that humans have always been aggressive and have these sort of darker impulses and have been irrational. And so there are a lot of anthropologists that have been discussing that lately about how primitive people were quite warlike and had very high murder rates. But there are other people who argue against that. So I had to read the other side. All sorts of other fields that I went into, a lot of philosophers are very wise about human nature, people like Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. And then novelists. I actually read novels because some of the most perceptive people are writers who understand, you know, are great observers.
So speaking of that, one of the things I think is interesting in the genre that you write in, I think you were part of, you were a pioneer in this, is that, so you did all this academic research, and most of the time when people do that, then they're like, this study says X, or they write about from their own personal experiences. You've always relied on historical stories, or in some cases myths, to illustrate your points. Right. Why do you talk to the reader as through story? Why have you always done that?
Well, I'm very focused on the reader. I'm always thinking when I'm writing, how are they going to absorb this information, right? And, you know, there's a problem that psychologists have noticed that if you're a teacher, you assume that your student has the same knowledge that you do, and then for you're a bad teacher. I know that my readers don't know necessarily what I'm talking about. They don't know if I'm talking about Carl Jung. If I throw out jargon, they're not going to get it. So I have to make it understandable to the average person.
Right.
Well, in The Art of Seduction, I talked about how telling a story lowers people's resistance, makes the mind open up. When we were like 2 or 3 years old, the sense of being carried by our parents or playing peekaboo, of not knowing what comes next, is very deeply ingrained in human psychology. So if I tell you a story about Rockefeller to illustrate aggression, I know as the reader is being pulled into this story, they don't know what I'm telling. They don't know who is the aggressor in this story.
Right.
They don't know the lesson that I'm trying to derive. So they're going to want to read. They want to go further and further and further. I've tricked them into coming to page 8. Whereas if I immediately hit them with Jung and this study and sociology, their mind closes off. They're falling asleep. That's the mistake 98% of people who write books out there make. They don't think about their reader. They assume that the reader is as interested in the material as they are. You have to seduce the reader, so I tell stories.
Is that a form of social intelligence then? You're sort of going, you're not thinking, oh, I'm right, or this is a fact.
Yeah.
You're thinking, how do I effectively deliver, what's the most effective way to deliver what I'm trying to do or get the end result that I want to get?
Yes, that's a very good point. So a lot of problems that people have in the social realm is they're not practical. So if you're thinking in terms of what you really want, it changes the whole game. If you want somebody to do your bidding, to help you, to finance your film or whatever it is, if you come at it from, oh, this is what I deserve, please give me this, I'm so brilliant, it has no effect. But if you think in terms of how they think, the stories they want to hear, what will please them, what will interest them, the game changes. You have the power to influence them. So I have the power to influence the reader when I start thinking about what the reader wants, how to draw them in. The key to my method of writing, I wrote a kind of a secret code to how I write books.
Okay.
It was chapter 31, I think, or 30 in the strategy book, the 33 Strategies of War. Communication, as I used Machiavelli as the prime example, and how you communicate, and what are the ways of styling your work that will have the greatest effect. So speaking in an authoritative tone, saying things that are kind of strong, are ways to get a reaction out of the reader. You want to get a reaction. You don't want that kind of mind-numbing feeling that you get when you read most books.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Ryan. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80. That's 80 to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
So, your book is obviously about human nature.
Yeah.
And you said to me, you said the number one law of human nature is that we deny there is such thing as human nature. And you have a quote from Horace in the book where he says, you can throw nature out with a pitchfork, but it always comes back.
Right.
So as we study human nature, what is it that, what do we discover? Like what are we trying to understand as we study human nature?
Very simple. You don't know who you are. You walk around in your world and you're kind of sleepwalking. You assume you have an identity, an opinion, an image of yourself that is actually somewhat false. You think you're maybe greater than you are. You think you're whatever that image is. But there's something else going on inside you. You don't know the source of your emotions. You don't know what really motivates you, what makes you tick. And they say the same thing about other people. So look at it this way. We evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. Throw away, it's not like we suddenly changed in 1970 and became this incredibly technocratic, sophisticated, pinker-like human being.
Yeah.
We started out as primitive, you know, Homo sapiens and before that.
Right.
Homo erectus, etc. And in that period, we were formed. So many things were formed about us, such as, just take one example, how we are so susceptible to the emotions of other people.
Sure.
Virality, mm-hmm. memes, etc. Well, that's something deeply ingrained because in our earliest ancestors, the ability to be affected by the emotions of other people was a key to their survival.
Sure.
Well, that is so deeply a part of us now, and we don't think of it. We don't understand that. So when you're interacting with people, you're being influenced by them in ways that you're not even consciously aware of because of this susceptibility to other people's emotions. I call these primitive forces that are operating in you. These primitive forces, there are 18 of them, is what I call human nature. And so they're actually governing your behavior and you're not very aware of it, and they're governing other people's behavior. I'm trying to open up this world to you and give you like a key to decoding some of the things that are so mysterious.
One of the primitive forces you talk a lot about in the book is envy, how either we're driven by envy and this is motivating us and we don't understand, or how we need to be cautious of and aware when other people are driven by envy, and that this is something we want to be both aware of and cautious about.
Yeah, I differentiate passive envy to active envy.
Okay.
So passive envy is something all of us feel. And what I really want you to do in this book is I want you to start being honest with yourself. Because I think if you're honest with yourself, you become a better human being and you're happier. Mm-hmm. So nobody likes to admit that they're envious, but everybody feels it. So you were disciple, or whatever you want to call it, mentee, not disciple. That was a bad word.
Protege,
thank you. You know, and then I read that you're higher up on the business list of writers than I am. Okay, I can't.
That was only because my book was for sale for $1. So okay, it's very temporary.
Okay, it doesn't matter. I'm just trying to honesty. I can't help but feel a pang of envy.
Right.
Okay? Everybody feels that. And I explain why we feel it. Chimpanzees feel envy. It's extremely ingrained in our primate nature.
Right.
We are always comparing ourselves to other people. It's how the human brain operates. On a very basic level, we process information by comparing.
Yeah.
How is this different from that? We do this socially. How does that person have more than I do? Why are they getting this attention and I'm not? You are feeling envy. Everybody feels it. Most of the time, it's not toxic. It's just part of social life. Just accept it.
Right.
But then there's the toxic, active form of envy.
Okay.
And I talk in this book a lot about toxic people. And I have a quote in there from Schopenhauer saying that we think that evil people walk around with horns on their head,
yeah,
or that fools have cap and bells.
Yeah.
But people who are toxic are masters at disguising it. They've learned since they were 3 years old to present a normal, saintly front to the world. Envious people, and there are envious people out there, don't go announcing themselves that they're right. envious. They become your friend in order to wound you. They ingratiate themselves out of a secret desire to find a way to punish you. I'm trying to teach you how to identify these types before they harm you, and I have, you know, many different cues.
So the idea of toxic people is definitely a theme in the book. What are some signs that you want to look for toxic people? I know you talk about Schopenhauer. He's like, you should tell someone good news about yourself and then judge right. how they react as a sign.
Right.
Which is that to see how if they're an envious person or not.
Yeah, in the envy chapter I talk about, and also in the chapter about body language, micro expressions, which is a sort of a fashionable word now. Paul Ekman kind of brought that out, where you look at people, they have a half of a second of a reaction, and then they put the mask back on.
Yeah.
Envious people will have that little slight for half a second. You will notice, if you tell them some bad news about yourself, a little smile will appear on their face.
Yeah.
Or if you tell them some good news, a little bit of something unpleasant will cross the face for just a millisecond.
Yeah.
And Schopenhauer said, you can find these people out by deliberately telling them something good that's happened to you or something bad, and they will reveal themselves. But, you know, there are certain chapters that I focus on very toxic qualities like envy, like the shadow, like the repression, like aggression, like short-sightedness, people who can't think past their nose.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to give you ways to identify them. So one of the most important keys is extreme behavior.
Okay.
So when someone reveals to you something, a very, what I call, emphatic character trait, they are hyper-confident, hyper-secure, hyper-aggressive, hyper-masculine, hyper-sensitive or temperamental, or very snobby about things, they're concealing something. They're generally concealing.
So compensating for something?
They're compensating. They're concealing what is probably the opposite quality.
Okay.
And they've learned that from very early on. So if you're an aggressive person, always trying to get what you want from other people, you know, you learn by the age of 11 that turns people off. So you learn to present a different front, like a charming front, and lure them in. So I want you to be aware of appearances are deceptive. People don't announce their toxicity to you with a trumpet blaring.
Right.
They disguise it. And they'll disguise it by presenting often the opposite appearance. So if somebody is so nice to you, you meet them, and they're immediately wanting to do you favors, and they're like, love your work, and they do this, that, and the other, probably there's something else going on under the surface.
Right.
Probably they're probably passive aggressive. So there are other signs, and each sort of toxic type has its own kind of identifying mark. Like I talk about aggressive people and how you can decode them often from their body language, their tone of voice. But the other thing about aggressive people, which is a toxic type, and I don't mean we're all aggressive, so I try to get that out of the way. It's not like, oh, some people are aggressive, some others. All humans are aggressive, but there are toxic aggressive types. What I want to train you, the reader, to look at is to not look at people's, what they say or their appearance, but to look at their actions
right.
and the patterns of their behavior. So, for instance, I talk about Howard Hughes in chapter 4 as somebody who's got a very weak character, who was a horrific businessman, and people were lured in by his image of this sort of maverick aviator,
right,
kind of, you know, great Hollywood person, etc. But if you looked at the patterns of his behavior, you would have seen that he was actually quite toxic. So stop looking at what people say about themselves and look at their actions.
And what's the expression now? When someone tells you who they are, you should listen? Or shows you who they are, you should listen?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things you talk about in this book, and I think it's kind of a theme in all your books, is sort of the art of persuasion.
Yes.
And you sort of lay out how understanding human nature and our own nature, I think the phrase you use in the book is a master persuader, like how to become. Mm-hmm. What does a person need to know to be better at persuasion?
Well, the first thing that I try and do, and there's a chapter in there, what I call is people have a self-opinion. And what I mean by that is you, Ryan, have an idea of yourself.
Right.
And that idea of yourself is I'm very self-reliant, I'm very disciplined, I'm a good person, I'm conscientious. I don't know what else is. I'm sure. A good father.
Sure.
They're mostly positive things, but there'll be negative things in that opinion of itself. You know, I could be better at that. It's how you think of yourself, okay?
Yeah.
And it anchors everything that you do. If you go buy a car, you're going to buy a car that sort of meshes with that self-opinion.
Right.
If you think of yourself as being extremely good with money and successful, you'll buy a Mercedes. But if you think of yourself as very conscientious and saintly, you'll buy a Prius. It governs so many of your choices.
Right.
Okay. When you are trying to persuade somebody or have influence over them, you are generally not thinking of this opinion that they have of themselves.
Right.
You're coming from yourself. You're thinking of what you want. You're projecting onto them qualities that they don't necessarily have.
Or see in themselves.
Or see in themselves. And if you inadvertently say or do something that crosses, that doesn't mesh with their self-opinion, a door will close that will never open again. You've lost them, right? So if you think of yourself as being really an independent person who makes up your own mind about things, and I try and say, oh no, Ryan, I think you've been manipulated. Well, man, you're going to get really angry. That's not how I think of myself. And you're not going to show it, but you're going to kind of inwardly turn away, turn against me. Well, that's the sin that most people commit. They don't understand that the other person has their own psychology, their own belief about who they are. Instead of violating their self-opinion, you want to validate it. There's a quote in there from William James is, the single greatest human need is to be recognized. People want to feel validated for who they are.
Right.
They want attention. They want to be recognized. I don't care who you are. That's what you want. If you can give that to people, if you can feed that self-opinion, if you can show that they are who they think they are, or you can kind of say that you could even be better at what you're doing, then suddenly they're open up to you. And now you have room to influence them, to change their behavior, to divert them in the direction that you want. So the number one principle is to stop thinking of yourself. When you find yourself in a moment where you want influence, when you want to persuade something, whether it's your boss, your child, your spouse, your first reaction is my needs, what I want, who I am. If you can train yourself, and it takes time, to stop that and to think of them and to put yourself in their position, to think of their psychology and of how they think about themselves, you've already come an incredibly long way towards having the ability to persuade them.
It's kind of remarkable to me, given your book's reputation as being ruthless and heartless and aggressive, that probably the number one theme in the laws of human nature is empathy. It appears in almost every law on every page about the importance of empathy. And that's sort of what you're saying there, that if you want to persuade someone, you first have to understand what they want and how they think, and not yourself.
Well, one thing I would correct on that is, people do think of me as being amoral, Machiavellian, but all of my books are all about getting inside the psychology of the other person. So I've always talked about that. I just never used the word empathy before. That's what people are going to think, that I've changed, but I haven't. But The idea there is we have a power, a hidden power. It's almost like a Superman type power that we don't use. And that power is empathy. It's our ability to think inside other people, to think inside of even other objects. It's sort of the origins of science itself. And so this empathy is not something that's intellectual. I like to take a lot of the things in this book, I try to take away from the intellectual realm. It's a visceral, emotional quality that we have. Mm-hmm. We can feel what other people are feeling. I can't really know what Ryan is thinking right now. You have a screen there, it's impossible. But viscerally, I can sense your moods through your body language, through things that communicate itself non-verbally. And so this ability to get inside the moods of other people, their emotions, their quality, their tone, is to me the essence of empathy. And if you think about it, our ancestors from hundreds of thousands of years had to survive in a world with predators, with saber-toothed tigers, with animals that were going to kill them in an instant, and warring tribes, before the invention of language.
Sure.
Right? And how did they communicate? They communicated nonverbally. They understood each other in a visceral way through nonverbal communication.
Right.
We have this power. And I have an icon in the book, Milton Erickson, a great psychologist who's sort of the inventor of hypnotherapy, who was a master at nonverbal communication. This is sort of the ideal world that we could somehow reach at some point.
One of my favorite parts in the book is related to empathy. You talk about most people go around and we have this idea of Schadenfreude, where we're sort of rooting for other people to fail, or we take pleasure in the defeats. And then you talk about, is it Mittenfreude?
Mittfreude.
Mittfreude.
Yeah.
What does that mean and why is it important?
Well, it's actually a phrase from Nietzsche. He says, we feel Schadenfreude, really we should feel Mittfreude. And Mittfreude, literally, Freude means joy. Schadenfreude means pain in joy, getting joy in other people's pain. Mittfreude means joy with, mit meaning with. And it means when other people have something good that happens to them, you feel their joy. So it's very unnatural. If somebody comes to you with good news, your immediate reaction is, most often is, I'm a little bit uncomfortable. Why not me?
Yeah.
Why you? Oh, maybe you're just lucky. Or, you know, you don't really deserve that. You're not, you know, you may not be honest with yourself, but that often happens.
Yeah.
Can you train yourself to actually feel the joy that other people feel when something good happens to them? It kind of opens up your whole mind, your whole spirit. One of the most important chapters in this book is the chapter on attitude and how your attitude towards life affects what happens to you. And I talk about Anton Chekhov, a Russian writer, who's to me one of the great icons for this book. And he had a horrifying childhood. His father beat him every single day, never even knowing why he beat him. They grew up in poverty. His father abandoned the family when he was young. He had nothing in life, and he lived in this miserable small town, the most miserable town in Russia you can imagine. And one day he decided, in the depths of his misery, after he was left alone in this town to look after himself at the age of 16, he said, I want to not feel this burdened by all of these bad feelings towards other people. I'm going to start thinking that my father can't help himself, that he was born a serf, and he's been bred to be this awful person. And my mother can't help herself, and my siblings, it's just human nature. I'm going to accept them, and I'm going to love them for who they are. And he felt this insane wave of freedom. He was free of all his own negative emotions that were burdening him day in and day out. And it changed the course of his life. So that's sort of the essence of Mittfreude in another way, of kind of accepting people for who they are and the sort of the freedom that ensues from that.
That connects to the thing that you and I made together, which is the Amor Fati coin.
Yes.
Which is the idea that it's also a Nietzsche phrase of sort of loving everything that happens to you, not resenting it, not fighting against it, not carrying around a grudge or a burden, but sort of embracing it and finding the good in it.
Yeah.
where does that fit in with our human nature?
Well, it doesn't fit in because it's not natural to us. Our natural frame, our natural starting position is when something bad happens, why me? You know, to feel sort of a grievance, to feel that things aren't fair, to feel that other people aren't giving you what you want or what you deserve. We start from a position of feeling kind of sorry for ourselves.
Right.
We deserve more than what we're getting. And so a lot of what I'm talking about in this book is overcoming some of these natural elements in human nature and turning them around and using them for another purpose, another way. And Amor Fati is very powerful in that you train yourself to accept everything that happens. It's sort of a banality to say that things happen for a reason, but there's some truth to it. It's like for Nietzsche, it was, this is life. Life involves pain. Life involves adversity. You're going to die one day and it's not going to be pleasant. Your friends and family members, they're going to die one day and it's not going to be pleasant. You're going to have failure in life. People are going to hurt you. But that is life. That's what it is. So to resist that, to be angry about that, means to not love life itself. And he wanted to turn that around and for you to embrace life because you only have one go at it and to embrace even the pain. He was struck at a very early age. There was this woman that entered his life named Lou Andreas Salome. I talk about her in The Art of Seduction. And she wrote a poem about how I embrace the pain that life has given me. I love it. I not only accept it, I love it. And he was so shaken by that. And he thought this was such a powerful way of thinking and being. So that you're going through and you're accepting life as it is and not wanting things to be otherwise is not natural, but it's extremely powerful. And I show you, I give you ways of how you can adopt this philosophy in your life.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next listen recommendations to habituate every type of thriller listener. The time is now more than ever to embrace breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that have enthralled you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped. My wife and I have both been raving about this book, Furious Hours, which is this true crime story that lo and behold, involves Harper Lee. And then even though I've been raving about the book for years and years, my wife finally listened to it on Audible. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. And now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/stoic right now. netsuite.com/stoic.
Obviously, you've gone through some adversity in your own life recently. Yeah. It's easy to talk about Amor Fati,
Yeah. Especially
when you're talking about, oh, I'm going to love that my plane is delayed or, Yeah. You know, that there's some trouble with the printer in my book or something. How have you tried to practice Amor Fati recovering from a stroke?
Well, you know what that's like. You were writing a book about stoicism and obstacles the way, and then you got robbed and you had all these things happen.
Sure.
And you were being tested. Well, I had a stroke and it's like the ultimate test for me. I've never had to go through something like this because I'm somebody who's very physically active and independent. And suddenly I can't use the left side of my body and I'm completely dependent. And the initial reaction is the natural reaction. Oh man, damn, why this had to happen? This is so unfair. Why me? You know, if only I could just keep swimming and doing my life the way it was. I'm so upset. And I talk in the book, your natural reactions, you don't have to fight them. You have to go take the next step, which is the next day after you've gone through this, is to analyze your own emotions and why you're feeling that way. So I've had to go through that process, and it's actually been extremely powerful for me. I've had to learn to accept this as the ultimate kind of training for me, for being stronger. This woman wrote to me, she was trying to give me advice. She said, look at this as sort of a new experience in your life, and you're going to discover new things. And I thought that was really a brilliant way of putting it. So I have to retrain my body. Every day I have to learn how to use my fingers again, like a baby. And I'm learning how the mind works. I'm learning about patience and frustration, about my own limits. And I can't necessarily say I love my stroke. I think that would be false of me to say something like that. I don't love that this happened, but I've accepted it and I've discovered how it can make me a better and stronger person. And so, you know, you write a book and it's kind of intellectual, and then something real happens. And what you write about is something that you yourself have to overcome. And it's really been like the most major test in my life so far.
And not to fast forward, because there's some other things I want to go back to, but I think it's related to what you conclude the book with, is this sort of extended memento mori, this meditation on our mortality.
Yeah.
And, you know, perhaps if the first law of human nature is we deny human nature, the last law of human nature is our denial of death and our mortality. Why is it so? Why did you decide to conclude this book, which is the laws of human nature, I sort of see as the culmination of all your work. Why did you give the most valuable real estate in your book to death?
Well, it is the end, so why shouldn't it be the last chapter? Right. It's sort of like, if I'm talking about how we have certain qualities that we have to accept, and through accepting them, try and move past them. So I'm trying to tell you, you feel envy, accept that, and now find a way to make envy useful. And I explain how you can start, instead of feeling envy, you can start feeling sorry for people who have less than you. You can start using your envy of powerful people to emulate them, etc. Well, death is the ultimate barrier for all of us, not just physically, but psychologically. I maintain that human beings are messed up, screwed up in so many ways because of their awareness of death and their fear of death. It is through this fear that we created all kinds of superstitions, that we created the idea of an afterlife. And so it's like Montaigne. I end the book with a quote from Montaigne, and he says, the ability to think about death and overcome the fear of death is the ultimate freedom. You're enslaved by this fear. You're not aware of it. It's controlling you. Overcoming it is the ultimate freedom. I have to end the book on that. But the idea is, most people are going to say, oh, that's not me, as they say for all of these chapters.
Other people, they're irrational, not me.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not really afraid of death. I play video games and I'm always killing people. And I watch movies and people are always dying. I'm not afraid of that. That's a cartoon version of death. Our culture was permeated with cartoon versions of death. Your death is something physical. It's going to happen to you. It's a very visceral thing. You are afraid of it. No matter how many video Black Ops games you play, you are still afraid of your own death.
Sure.
And that fear creates what I call latent anxiety. It makes you fearful of a lot of things in life and you're not aware of it. It makes you cautious about failure. It makes you cautious about taking risks. So I'm trying to show you that your fear of death has infected you on many, many levels. And so I compare it to this. I use the metaphor in the book. I don't use many metaphors, but this is one I use, is that death is like this vast ocean that we stand on the shore of. Most animals are not aware of their mortality. We are the only species, as far as we know, that's aware of its mortality. And here you are on the shore of this immense, vast ocean. You don't know what death is or what it's going to be, and you're afraid of it, and you turn your back to it. And we humans have the ability to explore things, to conquer our fear. And I want you, instead of turning your back, to actually enter that vast ocean and get and explore it and I show you ways of exploring the actual thought of your own mortality and how it can free you and inspire you in many ways.
Do you have any rituals or practices that you use in your own life as far as meditating on your mortality? And
well, I happen to be someone who's kind of obsessed with death. I have been since a child, so it's always in the back of my mind. And I meditate every morning, and not every time, but often I will try and physically think about my death and think about, I often imagine it like for some reason occurring in the afternoon. I've only seen one person die physically, and I talk in the book about how that's a real problem for us, that we no longer see anybody around us actually die. We don't even see animals die. We eat animals, but we never see them die except you. So I saw only one person die. That was my father. And it was a very visceral, powerful moment. I literally was holding his hand when he passed away. And I was very close to my father. And so I could sense, you know, in a very physical way, what that meant to me. And I think about that moment a lot. But also with the stroke, I came in probably an inch away from dying myself at that time. It wasn't like a brush with death like 50 had, where he was shot 9 times in the head. I'm not trying to dramatize things. But the doctors said I was very close to having permanent brain damage and to actually getting in a car accident because I was driving that could have been fatal. And so, you know, now that became something a lot more than just writing intellectually about it. And it's something I can think about all the time.
And it probably gave you a sense of your own fragility, how you could be totally healthy and fine and then like that.
And now I look at myself as someone who's been visited by death. And I see other people and I say that they haven't been visited by them. Like I'm separated them from somehow. And I think people who've had a brush with death feel that way. I know 50 expressed that to me.
And that's sort of an amorphous. So you now have an experience that's additive that other people haven't had.
Yeah.
So you've written about Stoicism. Obviously, I've written a lot about Stoicism. And we talked a little bit about this earlier, I think, but to me, the Stoics believed, you know, we were sort of naturally rational. They talked a lot about our rational mind. They appealed to reason. It strikes me that the laws of human nature is sort of about the war between our two selves, our rational self and our higher rational self.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious how you think about that battle or that process of how do we get from one to the other? Or I guess descending from one to the other.
Well, it's the paradigm for the whole book. It's the opening chapter. And I told you the paradigm is to understand who you are in order to change who you are. So law number one is we are governed by emotions. We are irrational. We think we're rational beings. We make rational decisions. We are not. We are irrational. And I pound that into your brain, showing you instant after instant why you are irrational, why I'm irrational, why you're irrational. With that awareness, you can begin to overcome it. You can say, oh, I have this particular bias. I'm always looking the confirmation bias. I'm always looking for the information or the news that will confirm what I already believe. When you admit that to yourself, you can do the disconfirming. You can look at other information. You're aware that you have, that your emotions come first and then you think later.
I know you're a lifelong student of the Stoics, and obviously I am too. And it's, you know, the Stoics talked about the importance and the power of reason, of being rational, of not falling prey to destructive or distracting emotions. And it strikes me that in The Laws of Human Nature, which is your new book, you're basically, your whole book is about the battle between our sort of lower irrational self and our higher rational self. And how do we get from one to the other?
Well, we get from one to the other by being aware of the lower self. So the lower self is the animal part of our nature. It's what makes us react emotionally to things. It's what makes us take the path of least resistance. We try and get shortcuts. We want immediate pleasures. We become addicted to things. We eat fast food.
Right.
Our higher self is less strong. It's like a voice that's weaker in our brain. That higher self you've experienced when you actually had an idea and you accomplished it, you executed it, you felt incredible rush of excitement that you actually did something that you thought you were going to accomplish. You have that higher self when you are empathetic to other people and you actually care about them and do a favor for another person. You feel better about yourself. I could go on and on and on. When you overcome your own weaknesses, you feed that higher self. It's a potential that each one of us has, and it's what we want in life. Now, the Stoics talk about logos and rational self, and that's sort of what I'm talking about in this higher part of ourselves. And the paragon of that I have in the book is Pericles, the great ancient Greek statesman. And Pericles is the paradigm for how to get out of that animal lower self.
Right.
And his decision was, as a human being, I am naturally emotional, and I want to worship something. I want to value something in life. I want to say, this is something that I love. For some people, it's money. For other people, it's wine and getting drunk. For other people, it's sex. You cannot escape that. That's who I am. What is going to be the thing that I worship? It's going to be reason. It's going to be Athena. It's going to be thinking, nous in ancient Greek. I am going to worship rationality. I am going to love it as this incredible power. And I'm going to turn it into an emotional thing. I'm going to love thinking for itself. Because if you just say, oh, I'm just going to be rational, it's kind of worthless, because
right.
You're always going to be fighting your emotions. But if in each situation you say, what gives me pleasure is not reacting in the animal way, but thinking my way through it, analyzing who I am, analyzing what I'm doing, and getting actual pleasure from that process, then you can conquer the lower self. And he is an amazing example, not studied enough in this world, because he practiced this as the leader of a great democracy under incredible amounts of pressure, making very important decisions all the time. And he was able to step away from all the heated arguing and irrationality that was plaguing Greek politics and find out a way of a middle course, a way of overcoming that in himself and in other people. So he's sort of the paragon for that.
And why do you think, if you look at where we are right now, politically, culturally, you know, in every way, if you pull up someone posts a political comment on Facebook or you're watching television, it appears that irrational thinking is the norm and that the lower self has taken over for almost everyone.
It's getting worse and worse and worse out there. I don't know what it is, if it's social media, we're going through a period like if you read a biography of Montaigne and where his moment when he was living in France, it was a moment of incredible turmoil and people were becoming insane and irrational. Maybe we're living through a moment like that. I talk in the book about, I have a book about generations and how things happen through history. And moments of great rationality in history are often followed by moments of extreme irrationality. It's what I call the animal spirits in us. We actually get pleasure from our emotions, from feeling anger, from feeling outrage. If your outrage and anger and hate can become addictive, it's the only way you feel alive. It gives you a rush of adrenaline. God, I hate that person. I hate Donald Trump. I want to kill Donald Trump, which is actually something I won't go into. But it kind of becomes literally a physical addiction.
Right.
And people are addicted to these emotions. It's the only way that they can feel alive. And to actually sit back and have to think about what they're saying on Facebook or how they're responding is painful. It's unpleasant. It means accepting that they could be wrong, that maybe their convictions and their outrage is misplaced, that their anger is foolish. Nobody wants to admit that. It's better to think, I'm righteous, I know what's right, fuck everybody else. And, you know, one of the main things in the book is we humans have aggressive impulses. I don't care who you are, the sweetest, most lovable person has aggressive impulses. And we have to find a way to channel them that are socially acceptable. Well, venting our outrage in social media and getting angry and saying, I hate these people, screw them, I'm gonna beat people up, is a way to vent your aggressive impulses, but disguise it to yourself. Right. Like, I'm not fighting because I'm violent. I'm fighting because I believe in a cause. Actually, you're fighting because you are violent. That is the primary motivation.
Sure. So we can wrap up here. You have this book. It's now out everywhere. You've worked on it for all these years. What do you feel like you learned about yourself writing this book or going through what you've gone through or now putting it out into the world that's either made you better or changed how you, you know, live or behave? What's the main thing that you feel like you said that sometimes you go through things after you've written a book and then you have to go back through and learn them and actually practice them? What do you think the main thing that you've taken away from this book that maybe you hope readers will also take away?
Well, it's altered how I look at other people. It's having lived with it for so long, I've always been someone that's kind of not accepting people for their appearance, trying to figure out what's going on behind the mask. But now I'm armed with much more knowledge and awareness and thinking. But the other thing that's happened is it's made me, in a weird way, kind of humbler, in that you write a book, particularly the books that I write, thinking, I've figured out the solution. I've answered this puzzle. I'm someone great. I'm God. And in writing this book, I realized, God, it's really, really difficult to understand people. The more I know, the less I know, in a way, that people are really, really complicated. An example that always crosses my mind is in sports, where so much now in sports is dominated by data and algorithms. But when I watch like a baseball, like the World Series or something, there's a spirit to a team, a way that they cohere as humans, sure, a way of relating to each other that no algorithm in the world could possibly solve. It's that element of the spirit, right?
Yeah.
Of the esprit de corps that will actually determine whether they win or not. And I don't care what nerd runs a team, that you can't figure that out.
Right.
Right? So when you're interacting with people, it's complicated. It's like three-dimensional, four-dimensional chess.
Sure.
And so it's made me kind of humble in the sense of, I don't really know people as well as I think. And it's kind of what Socrates...
And yourself, probably.
And even myself. So Socrates talks about, wants you to begin from a position of ignorance. That's the source of knowledge.
Yeah.
The source of knowledge is that you don't know anything, and therefore you're open to learning. So this has made me realize that I really, in some ways, don't know people as well as I thought I did, and I have to constantly learn and train myself and be open.
And so the book then sort of like, rather than being the end of your study of it, it's the beginning of it. It's like, I feel like the book poses a lot of big questions rather than gives you definitive answers on everything, because it's... You're giving data and stories, and then the reader is supposed to take that home and try to make sense of it, not just once, but over the course of their life.
Yeah, I want the book, you know, this is kind of the longest book I've ever written. I apologize for that. It's the longest book I've written, and I'm trying to immerse you in a whole way of thinking. I want to alter how you think about people from the inside out. So... It's not like I've come to you with all the answers, that now you just read my book and you have to apply what I say, A, B, C, and you will somehow magically succeed in life.
Yeah.
You have to take this information and apply it to yourself. You have to look at yourself and realize, think why you are irrational, when you feel envy, what your shadow is like, what your attitude is towards life. I'm posing a challenge to you, and the book is sort of, will you meet this challenge? So in that sense, it is kind of open-ended, and it depends on the reader.
If you're liking this podcast, we would love for you to subscribe. Please leave us a review on iTunes or any of your favorite podcast listening apps. It really helps. And tell a friend. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.